saying how much they want a strong woman. What they really want is a cheerleader.
I'd like someone who's physically very frail and won't stop talking.
I just want what everybody wants. I just seem to have a harder time getting it.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Maximum Film. It's episode 290, Air Jordan 4, and we are talking about movies yet again. It's your host, Ify Whiteyway, and in the booth with me are my friends. So let me introduce you to them. First up, coming in at point guard, standing at a 6'5", weighing 189. It is none other than the Christmas Zaddy himself, Maximum Film's favorite critic, Alonzo Duralde. What is good?
Oh, God. Ify, we've clearly spent so little time in each other's company. If you think either of those measurements is remotely correct. What's good with me is, I have to admit, I live in the movie theater. It's hard for me to find time for other stuff. But I went out to the theater this weekend. I saw the Touring Company of 1776. A musical we have discussed on this program before y'all were here, which I have always been a big fan of, even though it is kind of dorky. It is a movie. It's a musical about the signing of the Declaration of Independence. But this production, which began on Broadway and is now making its way around the country, is kind of the post-Hamilton version. The entire cast is cis women, trans women, and non-binary performers, many of them of color, playing the founding fathers. And it works. I think that when 1776 premiered in the late 60s, just the idea of the founding fathers being like horny and drunk and, you know, torn about, you know, what was a good idea, felt shocking and new and interesting to audiences. And I think at this point, to get that same level of wow factor out of it, you can't just do the same old, same old. And so they've really done it differently. This is a show about how we failed to take slavery out of the Declaration of Independence. So, you know, I think when you have this cast that is gender diverse and racially diverse, it really, you know, puts a whole new spin on it. But the songs are still great and the material is still terrific. So I'm so glad I saw it. And I want to urge folks, if it's going to be near you, go see this production.
I want you to know, as someone whose family took her to Monticello on a family trip, I've always only considered the Founding Fathers horny and drunk, like there primarily. Yeah. It's been right there at the top of my signifiers.
Oh, well, you know, being at the top actually leads us to our next friend, you know, a super festival programmer, producer, known as the Ron Artest of the Midwest.
Power forward.
It is none other, coming in at 7 feet tall, 220 pounds, Drea Clark. What's good?
That's an alarming. You just described me as an avatar creature. I'm a Navi. That's what I am. That's fine. I'm comfortable with that. What also I'm comfortable with is my what's good as a lady who's embraced her middle age. I've also been very much happy with Coachella having such a beautiful online festival at this point. Like, my years of going to Coachella in real life consisted a lot of, like, the later it got, it was just me in the back of the crowd, completely distracted by girls who were way too drunk or high, and me just being like, where are your friends? What is, don't touch her, sir. Do you know her? Like, a lot of that energy. And I don't have to do any of that from home. And they've also so beautifully set up, especially for like the headliners. It is set up as a stage show. I mean, there's just like beautiful camera work going on. I'm now a Blackpink fan. I'm a Blink, which I believe is what they're called. But yes, very much enjoying online Coachella. And there's a whole other weekend when this comes out. So, you know, join me. Yeah. Middle age it up.
Yeah, yeah. Get in that chat room and hang with those twins. Lord was known to be watching. So you're in there with Lord digitally.
Ooh, of hydrating.
Yeah. Well, look, you know, we got a special position right here. We got a power guester coming in at 6'9", 240 pounds. It's none other than writer, comedian, just good friend of the pod, writer of the official power ranking of Bostonians. It is Josh Gondelman. What's good?
Yay, welcome.
Thank you for having me. It's so nice to be here. I am once again fully consumed in season two of Yellow Jackets. I don't know if that's been a what's good yet so far this season, but it was a show that I found midway through season one. My wife and I caught up real quick, watched the second half as it aired. I also, what's good is a week over week viewing model. I think that is how I prefer to watch, especially a tense drama where I think if I watched three episodes in one night, I would just shiver for a while. And Yellow Jackets, if you don't know, it's about a soccer team, a girl soccer team from New Jersey stranded in the woods by a plane crash. And then how the kind of echoes of that have affected the surviving members in 25 years later, in 2021, I think they're set. It's great performances. I think like they've really been showcasing the adult ensemble as opposed, in addition to the teen ensemble, but Melanie Lynskey has just had some great scenes. Christina Ricci. It's just been really fun, and like I'm really squeamish, but for some reason I'm like super in on this kind of horror series. It's fun, it's tense, it has the right balance of like, oh, this is like something really messed up is gonna happen, and then like, oh, that's something really silly also happened. And I really like the way it creates tension, punctuates it, raises questions, lingers in this kind of weirdness. And so for someone who doesn't watch a lot of shows like that, this one is like, I can't wait for the next episodes every week.
Agreed.
Ooh. They're so good. And it also has like it hits the sweet spot of 90s nods because you have like these flashbacks to them in high school. So these are ladies of my age. So I'm like, oh, yes, I know every music cue you're going to drop on this song. And I'm grateful for it.
My wife is basically the age of the characters and came from basically right where that fictional New Jersey, ooh, like, because they make up the name of a town. And so she's from basically has triangulated that it's like within probably 10 miles of where she grew up.
Nice. She played them in soccer.
Definitely. She sang against them in musicals. Yeah.
They all got into a fight at prom. Yeah. Yes. Iffy, what's good?
What's good with me is actually on the same wavelength as Josh. You know, I haven't started Yellow Jackets yet because we started Alice in Borderland season one so that we can be ready for season two. We're down to the final episode of Alice in Borderland, so we will start on Yellow Jackets after we finish. But another great, dark, funny, gritty film, and it has that added bonus that we just got back from Japan. So like we're recognizing locales, and we're like, yeah, it is crazy that, you know, Shibuya looks like this when we've seen the real Shibuya. So really good time on that. And if you didn't know, because it, you know, Netflix is real great at underselling any of their shows, but there is a season two if you did not know. So
another TV show I've never heard of and now need to watch, apparently.
Yeah. It's an easy watch, 8 episodes, 1 hour episodes, but 8 episodes, first season and second season. Cool. And it's looking like, you know, I'll know for sure in a bit, but it's looking like it's going to wrap up in season two, which, you know, I love a neat story. Mm.
Yeah.
I like a complete story.
Yeah.
So hopefully they'll actually get to tie it.
I feel like, you know, they're like, we've seen Netflix's plan. Let's wrap this story up in season two.
Shut it down. Yep.
Oh, rely on a season three? No.
Yeah, exactly. Well, look, it's time for the only movie for grown-ups about a shoe. We're talking about Air. Then we'll pitch some other corporate biopics that we might want to see. But first, it's time for Itadick, our movie news segment where we take a look at some headlines from the last week and ask, is this important? Do I care? Andrea is about to lead us up with the first one.
I really am. So a firm called Luminate put out their Entertainment Diversity Progress Report this past week. I'm sure you guys all know, you probably had an alert set for that.
Oh, yeah.
It measured the changes between 2021 and 2022 in film and television in both acting and directing. Percentages of Asian main title cast and directors increased by single digits. Meanwhile, Black actors were main title characters in 20% more films than in the year before, though fewer films overall were centered on Black stories. Roles for LGBTQ+, female, Latinx, Native American, Middle Eastern, and disabled actors were also tracked, but few significant changes were found year over year. That said, Luminate plans to continue this tracking in years to come. 2021 was the first year they measured. Mm. Is this important? Do you care?
Mm. Yes.
I wish I were surprised, but yes, yeah. It's important.
Yes.
It says that there were not significant changes. Those were all down. I'll say across the board, other than female directors and some female-led film, which went up in a small way, all of those other things were down. Like, disabled representation is the lowest across the board and has been an issue in front of and behind camera forever. I'm certainly glad they're tracking. I mean, sure. I guess I'm speaking for all of us, big Luminate fans here. Love the Entertainment Diversity Progress Report. I'm always texting the guys, is it out yet? So real excited about that. But it's hard. Like, yeah, great that they're tracking. Too bad it's all an effing bummer all the time.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think this plays to a larger thing where I'm just trying to imagine at some point, do like studios begin to embrace a business model where they make more cheaper films that maybe sort of narrow cast out to certain audiences rather than try and get everybody to show up for these big blockbusters? And I tragically think know the answer to that question, but I think it just seems to be a terrible idea and a bad way of doing business. You know, I think the bottom is going to drop out of superheroes at some point, even though superheroes could be diverse and have been, but so rarely are. So yeah, you know, this is where we are, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, look, we all know the most diverse superhero franchise is and will forever be the Fast franchise. They really, you know, led.
Superhero franchise.
I came out the gate.
I really thought you were going to say the Burger King Kids Club.
I mean, that is also correct.
Close second.
Yes. You know, I'm glad that these organizations are doing this because I think it gives a lot of bargaining power going forward, kind of seeing the shortcomings and kind of being able to show it to the folks who need to see this. Mm-hmm. And I'm gonna just keep that perfect alley-oop of a segue about bargaining power and let Alonzo take it from here.
Yes, so see, I can't make up these segues, but if he can, the Writers Guild of America members have voted overwhelmingly to authorize a strike. The guild that represents screenwriters for most film and TV shows has been given permission by its voting body to strike if the guild can't reach a new deal with studios. Nearly 98% of members voted in favor of that authorization. This is fresh news on the day we're recording, so by the time this episode drops, who the heck knows where we'll be with this story. But deadline for negotiations is May 1st. Is this important to WGA members who are in this room, and do you care?
Yes.
I do, yeah. Yes. And just a small clarifying, the 98% is of the members who voted, which I believe was in the upper 70s of overall. So it was a really huge turnout. It was a higher turnout than the 2007 strike and a higher voting to authorize So yes.
And if you don't vote, you can't bitch.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. Yeah, truly.
Yes. And so this is, I think a lot of people probably remember the writer's strike in 2007 going into 2008. That was a lot about like digital jurisdiction and do writers get any piece of things that air on what was like then kind of this emerging, what became streaming. And now that business model has clarified, it's really depressing writer wages from TV and film. It's barely keeping, you know, not really keeping pace with inflation. Shorter seasons of shows are keeping writers out of rooms. There are mini rooms, which kind of small rooms that work to do a lot of the hard work of breaking stories before the full writer's room starts, often on a show that hasn't been greenlit yet. And it's just the industry has changed so much in the last 15 years. And I think it's really a great show of solidarity that the Writers Guild membership has taken this stand to say, like, look, we're ready to negotiate hard to take a piece of the earnings that we generate for these giant companies, that we help generate for these giant companies alongside other, you know, people that make these entertainment products. And I think it's like a really good sign, hopefully, that there is so mm-hmm. much strength and solidarity across WGA membership.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, this is extremely important. I mean, if you've heard me talking on the pod up until this point, that this is like the final frontier, because streaming mm-hmm. has changed the way that TV, you know, works, you know, especially on that back end, how writers get paid side of things. I think the best example is, like, say, for example, somebody wrote on a wine-based Friends hangout show, and they got a second season. And then right before the second season, normally before back in the day, in the before streaming, they would air those old episodes so that people can get into watching it, get the hype back. But now you don't need to do that. You can just let it live on streaming, and people will do that themselves. So the difference between that is writers have to be paid every time their episode is aired. So now, instead of airing the episode
on conventional television.
So instead of paying us out for all these times that people have watched it to get ready for the new season, instead we get this blanket, rarely seen amount from streaming.
And film as well, right? I think it's been really hard on film writers and. Because it used to be, you know, a film would have a theatrical run, then it would go to DVD, and that would be another source of revenue, and then it would maybe be aired on television, and then maybe it would end up on something like a Netflix. And now, with Netflix making its own movies, it airs, and, you know, it runs, it's there, you get a kind of token residual, and then even if it's, you know, Netflix brags it, Bird Box is the most times anyone's ever looked at anything in all of human history. Take that, the Mona Lisa. And yet there's no bonus for, like, writing something that's extremely successful or acting in. These problems are industry-wide, directing, but it's currently the Writers Guild is the first of the major guilds to, like, go in for this essentially collective bargaining agreement, ours.
And the last strike lasted around 100 days.
Yeah.
So it went for a minute. And depending on how long this one may or may not, again, this doesn't mean there's automatically mm-hmm. a strike. Yeah. It just means that it's a collective bargaining unit so that when the WGA is in these continued talks, now they have the weight, they have that mm-hmm. leverage of, oh, our entire membership is behind us and we are authorized to strike if you can't come to our terms. It ups those things.
And in 2017, there was a strike authorization that was actually a stronger vote by percentage than in 2007, and not quite as strong. Like, this one was incrementally higher than that one, but that, I think, averted a strike, or helped to, right? Because there was no strike despite incredibly strong authorization, because that means that this show of power and solidarity at the negotiating table meant that the AMPTP, the big alliance of production companies, took the writers seriously and said, like, oh, we see that you mean business, and we don't think we can break you, like, it's going to cause us more pain financially than it will cause you.
Yeah, and when they keep publishing the, like, $50 million mm-hmm. bonuses mm-hmm. that the CEOs are getting, mm-hmm. it really sort of shoots them in the foot.
Oh, yeah.
We're very pro-union here anyway, absolutely. Above and beyond having our little WGA baby on our team.
Yeah, that's a fun little thing into to mention that, you know, when we're at the table bargaining, the WGA is not speaking to media. So any of this, like, wild news that you hear about writers that comes out from Variety or any other industry publication, it's not from us. It's usually coming from who we're bargaining with to, you know, make us look greedy or bad. So that's worth noting. Another thing I'm just sharing is the assumption that the last strike brought upon the reality era, which has been debunked because it was only 100-day strikes. And if you work in TV, you know it takes longer than 100 days to get something to go. It was already in the pipeline. But, you know,
it takes 100 days to set the pitch meeting.
Yeah.
Yes. But, you know, just yeah, I saw that say be wary of little press releases that come out, except for this one, which is the fact that Vidiot's is finally opening in L.A. Yes. You know. Vidiot's has a strong place in all of our hearts. I'm one of the founding members of Vidiot's. You know, shout out to Drea for introducing
me. I was going to say, I am as well.
Yeah.
Because we're twinsies. Like I would never let you go, you know, alone into that forest.
Oh, yeah. But, yeah, no, introducing me to Maggie as well, though, who is just very... gung-ho for dumb ideas like the horny movie fest that is definitely on the horizon and some other like cool things that's popping. So I'm excited. I mean, it's in my neighborhood, and I think it's this, you know, great, essentially soon to be, hopefully, this institution run by women and is all about, you know, doing what we like to do here, which is highlighting the voices in film that don't usually get to get high lit because our skin isn't as lit, or our, you know, sexual preferences or gender isn't as lit. The analogy doesn't work as we go down it, but you get what
I'm saying. No, nailed it. Nailed it. That's why you're the writer.
Yeah.
This is the importance of scripts, everybody. Like.
It's opening June 1st, and it will be equipped with 35mm and 60mm and digital screens. I did a little walkthrough this last week. It looks great. I'm so geeked about it, and I'm so geeked to try and get Drea drunk in Eagle Rock while we watch, you know, something weird, I guess. Alonzo, too. Alonzo, come on out. Let's get.
He just assumes Alonzo's already going to be drinking.
We are a trifecta. I figure we're all coming out. And also, I genuinely look forward to when everything is feeling good and safe enough, getting some live Max films in there. And
oh yeah,
and, so like 2027. Yeah. I'm in. This is exciting. In addition to being a theater space in LA, and if you're ever here, I do hope you come visit and support it. It is also the Vidiot's library. They've been collecting, we are physical big fans media. Of physical media, exactly. And it's an enormous rental space. It started in Santa Monica, but the films that they've collected and curated have been really broad. They have an incredible array of like indie films that probably only Alonzo and I have ever seen, and a community space. So we're psyched for that here. And also use that as a reminder, wherever you are, please, if you have local art house cinemas and places that still rent, let that be part of your community.
Yeah.
Go support them. Go get things. You can maybe have your own version of a Vidiot's that you may not know about.
Look,
and we always encourage you to check those.
And as a stand-up, I love doing a stand-up show in a video store. Mm-hmm. Go there, get people in there, buying their snacks up, buying the stuff up, and guess what? A fun, funky venue that isn't a shitty bar where we're yelling over people drinking. I will do a video store over a bar any day of the week. Okay. Well, on that great note, we're going to take a break, but when we come back, we're talking air.
Hey there, beautiful people. I am your favorite authoress, Treyvelle Anderson, of We See Each Other, a Black trans journey through TV and film.
You know this is supposed to be a promo for our show, Fanti, and not your book, right?
It's called Multitasking.
I can't with you right now. Treyvelle and I have an award-winning show called Fanti that we both host, and it's a podcast where we dig into the complex and complicado conversations about the gray areas in our lives.
Perhaps there is a public figure of some sort, and you're like, oh, that person's so smart and so charming, but you're also like, that person gets on my nerves.
Okay. You can catch us every week right here on Max Fun or wherever you get your Slayworthy audio.
And you can watch us on the YouTube every Friday.
That's Fanti, F-A-N-T-I.
Welcome back to Maximum Film. I'm your host, Evie Wadiway. In the studio with me are...
Drea Clark.
Josh Gondelman.
Alonzo Duraldi.
And today's film is set in 1984, 4 years before the birth of Ify Shakude. Michael Jordan's rookie year in the NBA, and it reunites lifelong collaborators and buddies Ben Affleck and Matt Damon, and marks the first time that Damon has been directed by Affleck. Viola Davis, Chris Tucker, Jason Bateman, and Chris Messina also star. So Drea, would you mind giving us a brief synopsis of Air?
All right, so Air is set in the 80s, which you know throughout, because you'll know every single song that is played in this motion picture, and you'll love it. It is the Nike is the third place challenging upstart in the world of sports shoes, specifically basketball shoe divisions, which is certainly a division that is a thing that I absolutely knew about before this. And the guy that they've brought on board, Sonny Vaccaro, who's a talent scout, it is on his shoulders to bring this fledgling division up to task. And if not, everyone's going to lose their jobs. And so he decides to put it all on a young rookie named Michael Jordan. He's convinced this young man's going to be a star, and he has to sweet talk his family into even getting considered. So yes, it is a sports shaped movie, but the sport is contract negotiations.
Yes.
The most dangerous game.
Yeah.
Air, the most dangerous game. Yes.
Well, to kick this movie off, I have a thought that I just genuinely had. Like,
Dre didn't say the title yet.
I did. Air.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
I do like to. Thank you, Alonzo.
Wanted to be sure.
Please continue to hold us accountable. The name must be said at the end of every synopsis. Or so help me. This movie, before I went into it, didn't feel like it was. I feel like Oscar bait feels so derogatory, but like an Oscar, like you know, you know what I mean. Like,
it's a biopic of a shoe.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's being released in April.
But I
yeah.
say all this to say, like, a lot of just performances, like, and not, you know, like people, here's the thing, Viola Davis, every time she's on screen, you're like, this is like the Michael Jordan of acting. Like, it is absolutely so funny how effortless, but I'm talking about, like, Matt Damon, I was like, okay, you know, I've tweeted this already.
You mean multiple Academy Award nominee Matt Damon?
Okay, yeah, but you know,
one Academy Award winner Matt Damon.
Yeah, no, yeah, yeah,
for
fair,
screenplay
fair.
Writing.
Yes, and yeah, Affleck yeah. has two, one for yeah. director.
But you,
or no,
you
not
know,
for directing.
No, 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 for picture.
Best picture. He wasn't nominated for best director.
Yes.
Yeah.
Why did it seem like you were happy about that, Josh?
I just think it's funny. I like. I have so much affection for Ben Affleck in my heart. There's no time to get into it up top. We'll dip that away.
Yeah, no.
You have to win the crowd over
yeah.
before you reveal the deep Affleck love. I'm in the same
performances.
Spot.
I think the scene stealing performance is Chris Messina.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah.
Who's great as like powerful sports agent David Falk, a real person.
Oh yeah.
And then
yeah.
the guy from Our Flag Means Death, whose name I've never remembered, who plays the shoe designer, I thought
oh,
was
right,
tremendous.
Right. Oh
well.
Yes. That was, he's yeah.
So good.
So good.
Matthew Mayer.
He's yes. great.
Amazing. Yeah. It was just really fun. And in one of the prompts here is that we all know what happens at the end because, mm-hmm. you know, a couple of us in here own enough pairs of the shoes. But I think with all that being said, it is these performances that make you feel so engaged with the story because you're so invested in these characters or these people that you know
yeah.
have been played, but I for the non-shoe owners and wearers, well, you own shoes.
I mean, we live like, in this world. Like, I'm familiar with Michael Jordan and the shoe
but
with
like
his
the sneaker
body
head.
On it. Well, but the I'll say that you're absolutely right. Like, there is something about and ironically, there was a trailer for Oppenheimer. You knew I would have the same point to make about both of those that I'm like, yeah, I know where both of these end. Like, I know what happens with that bomb, and I know what happens with that shoe, right?
Yes. 1776, same thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Right? So it's the telling of it, and I absolutely agree, Iffy, that because there was not a sense of urgency of, oh my God, is he going to get it? It's still structured in a way that you're wondering each step of the way, no pun intended, sorry, shoe movie, but each step of the way you're following the revelations of the personal investment that these men have in this company, in this shoe, in what it means for them as how they identify as businessmen in whatever departments they're in. And so that gave me the consequences needed to be on board and to still feel like, oh, this is clicking. It doesn't matter that I know that in this universe, yes, I know those are Nikes. Like, I know Michael Jordan is going to say yes to this deal they're putting together. It didn't, like, deflate it for me. I was like, oh, I'm getting so much interesting character beats around every person involved with it. And that is what elevated it and kept me engaged.
Yeah, I call this the Apollo 13 test. Like, is it still interesting and suspenseful even though you know it's going to happen? And as somebody who does not care about sports or very expensive basketball shoes, I did have a good time with this movie because it's a movie about process. You know, it is, like you said, it is about the steps, you know, about each thing. Okay, if we can, all right, this window is closed. So what door do we look for now? And how do we get this person to agree to take that meeting? And all of those pieces together was really fascinating. I have done a show online with Ben Mankiewicz. And one of the things that he always likes to talk about is movies about people who are good at their jobs. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's what this is. And Michael Jordan isn't even one of them. Like, yeah. he is in this movie the way Jesus is in Ben-Hur. Like, you get the back of his head occasionally, but that's it. It's about all these other people who are good at their job.
You see him kind of like the adults in Muppet Babies, like the reverse of that.
Exactly. The ankles.
Yeah,
Charlie Brown.
Yeah.
There are a lot of good, like, really fun performances, these really propulsive process stuff. I kind of would have liked to have seen a little more scenery chewing in some corners. I feel like Ben Affleck set himself up to play such a fun kind of zany version of Phil Knight, and then sometimes he grounds it like a little too subtle, and I'm like, ah, like, you should be operating on that Christmas Cena level too. Like, it had the same kind of feel to me as it felt a lot like The Big Short, where there were a lot of fun performances, but I wish that either they'd gone a little bigger and more fun with it or grounded it with these relationships. Like, I think we started with Matt Damon and you see him at a high school basketball tournament and he's working the crowd and talking to the players. Then he goes to Vegas and he wins big and he loses big. And you're like, this is a man who is like really wheeling and dealing. And then the rest of it is in Beaverton, Oregon at Nike headquarters, where he's like in an office looking at the rain and like watching grainy videos. And I just kind of wish there were a little more, we felt a little more of like, oh, this is like a gambling man. And like the gamble that we know he's making, the big gamble is giving Michael Jordan $250,000 too much money. And you're like, you know, the whole time you're like, absolutely not.
Yeah.
Well, but you know, as much as this movie like can't stop reminding you that it's 1984, to the extent that they literally stop in the middle of the movie to show you like Trivial Pursuit and a Ghostbusters bumper sticker. This movie has such a boner for the 70s. Mm-hmm. Like, so many filmmakers of this age, like, you can tell that Affleck is thinking about this, like, how would Sidney Lumet tell this story? You know, and so you get these like kind of half shadowy rooms and dudes talking to each other about how they never see their kids and, you know, all that stuff. And it works, but like, there's definitely a 70s kind of like corporate vibe going on. Although the irony being that nobody in the 70s would be caught dead making a movie that kisses the ass of a horrible company like Nike this hard.
Well, you know, this is a perfect time to talk about, in the grand scheme of things, you know, it is this like movie about this corporation. But there are times, so many times, where you can tell that they're very self-aware. And I think that's almost why it's like that improv thing where it's like, I'm being too crazy. And it's like, no, this is like you've earned this. You don't need to rein it in. But like, you know, calling out the weird German ties of Adidas in the movie, you know,
like Adolf.
Yeah.
You mean his name is Adolf.
And that's legit. That's all real.
Yeah, that's all real. Yeah,
but the words child labor are never made.
I know. Yeah, not at all. Well, you know, it was very interesting because like there are like sneaker tidbits that are in there that are real. Like one of the big things was he was talking about how they make it in Taiwan and he doesn't like it. And that's an actual big thing in the sneaker world of Nike jumping and making shoes in China. Mm-hmm. Like if you have a Jordan that says Taiwan on it, like that's a OG Jordan. Another sneaker tidbit was the bands. So the Jordan 1s, red and black, Chicago's, were originally called the Band 1s because they tried to ban him from wearing it, even though Nike was like, we'll pay this fee. And they're like, no. And it changed the sneaker in the NBA game forever. And I think, you know, it is funny how what you're saying, Josh, there are so many things about this story that has utterly shook the world of basketball. Totally. And they only kind of like
talked about the air bubble, right? David Fox is yelling at him about the air bubble in the shoe, which you never even really see because it's not visible in the Jordan 1. And so it's like, yeah, it's very interesting. There's a lot they cram into it that I'm like very intrigued by. And that kind of like those little historical details, I think are really kind of fun story. It also, I don't think this is too much of a spoiler. It has the same ending as Babylon. Where there's like
but more earned,
more earned for sure, and it's more like it's like an impossible flash forward to real life from the world of the movie. It's like a sequence where you're just like seeing the future flash before the character's eyes, but even though it's earned, right? You're like, yes, Michael Jordan is certainly the greatest basketball player of his era, possibly of all time, and so it does like that. Knowing that does a lot of the heavy lifting of like the gravitas of like how important all these meetings are, because we all know how it turns out, but we know.
Right. It's the gravitas, but it's also that fun idea of the prescient knowledge mm-hmm. that Sonny Vaccaro had. Like the idea of, I watched this tape, and when he's describing it, like he's going through footage and you get the idea of, oh, he watches high school players. Like this is a talent scout who actually can identify talent, like raw, pure talent. And even me, I'm watching this playback from Michael Jordan's freshman year of college and him waiting for this like shot that I never knew was a shot or whatever. And even me hearing that and analyzing, I was like, oh yeah, that is star power. Like there's something so it's set up well. The other thing of this movie that I was so pleased by, it's bro heavy.
Very bro-y.
Bro times for days. There's a couple ridiculously gorgeous secretaries, and that's and then obviously Mrs. Jordan, and that's sort of end of the list for female characters. That said, I watched this and was like, oh, Ben Affleck is telling a story of how, in fact, in our society, men can't have it all either, because all of these men are divorced. None of them are raising their children. They're not part of their families. Like you have Jason Bateman's character talking about how he gets his kid for 4 hours on Sundays. So it is certainly not the takeaway for most viewers, but for me, that subtext meant a lot. It was, oh no, nobody can do it all. Like there's no such thing as work-life balance. Like if you care this much, you're invested that like, things fall off the cliff. And so watching it and having the acknowledgement that, because if this movie had had that tired ass scene of Matt Damon going home to his wife and being like, and her putting it on the, like, oh, you know, you're putting us all at risk. Is this worth it? Like, well, I would have stabbed someone. So like, instead,
don't go out
being
and break
like,
the sound barrier tonight, honey. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. I'm like, no, instead, this is a dude who feeds himself regularly at the 7-Eleven.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they're all lonely and they're all alone. Like and just the time spent on that angle of it, I was like, thank you. That's some beautiful filmmaking.
A detail that I really appreciated was that Viola Davis's makeup is perfectly 1984 in a way that most women in period pieces don't want to do because it is not particularly flattering.
Yep.
I remember, and this is the movie that I always go back to on this one, is Glitter, where Mariah Carey is like looking great, but very, you know, 21st century. But Anne Magnuson, playing the publicist for her label, is, and who lived it, like who knows that era very well, is wearing the very oily, brightly colored makeup. And it's like, yeah, that's what the 80s mm-hmm. looked like. Unlike Iffy, 84 was the year I graduated from high school. My first pair of running shoes in high school cross country was a pair of Nike waffle trainers. I really, that was a piece of detail that I really liked. And I liked that she went with it. Because I'm sure a lot of actors are like, oh, no, you're not going to make it look like that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Another risk that this movie had was it ran the risk about, you know, something, you know, extremely huge in black culture that centers around white mm-hmm. people. Like that, it ran that huge risk. And what it does well is, one, not only, you know, include the people of color who were involved in it, but also, like, I like the relationship he had with the cashier mm-hmm. where he was checking in and he was getting, like, basketball stats from him. I liked that, like, it's such a subtle, cool thing that you wouldn't expect from a Bostonian.
I'm saying Ben Affleck doesn't care about the culture. That's cool.
look,
he's in an interracial marriage.
Yes, I will pay respects to Jenny from the Block, but that you know, Chris Tucker's character mm-hmm. tapping in with the family and how important that relationship is,
and the code switching.
The code mm-hmm. switching, that was so amazing.
And then the fact that the first thing out of his dad's mouth was like, "Oh, you're the one brother in here," and they immediately click, and I was like, yeah, that is a thing that could fly over mm-hmm. most people's things, where it is important, where it's like, oh yeah, if I'm going to be working with this company, I don't want to be just shuffled around. And that leads back into like that self-awareness I was talking about, where it also kind of talks about, you know, the rights of the players, mm-hmm. how like a lot of these white mm-hmm. men own these basketball sneaker companies, these teams, and they have these, you know, well-compensated young men, you know, under them, but they don't have health care. And I think the thing that a lot of people forget is they think if you make it to the NBA, you're rich. And it's like, no, if you're Michael Jordan, mm-hmm. you're rich. If you're LeBron James, you're rich. If you're, you know, James Worthy, you're rich. But there are so many, if you think of how many people are on a basketball team, there are so many people who play maybe a season
five.
Or two. no, there's nope. more than five. Nope.
Nope.
But there's just so many people who get lost in the shuffle. And so things like, you know, players getting a percentage of their sneaker, mm-hmm. things like.
Which I did not know.
Yeah. Yeah.
That, when that hit in the movie, it's like, oh, mm-hmm. like suddenly this is a film about labor.
Yeah exactly.
I would love to see a film about the O'Bannon versus the NCAA case that Sonny Vaccaro was central in, which got college athletes the right to be compensated for like likeness rights and stuff, because that's been such a huge labor issue. And it's really I didn't realize that the same person was involved in both of these kind of landmark athletic labor decisions.
Well, they build it in such a way that we don't see it coming. Like mm-hmm. when it's Mrs. Jordan, why don't I remember her first name?
Dolores.
Thank you, right? Dolores. Dolores Jordan is doing the negotiating for this deal essentially herself at this point, and speaks so truthfully about like what her son's worth is and how she values him, but also that he should value himself in that way. Like, it's just beautiful things in there about the idea of worth and value, which in the corporate scheme of it. But when she introduces this concept, Sonny, our buddy Matt Damon, is like, oh, we don't pay, like, that's not, it's so game changing.
Yeah.
There's no world where he is poised. And this is the last 15 minutes of the movie. Like, it's not like this whole time it's, ooh, I wonder if they're going to ask. No, no one's asked for this. It is setting a precedent. Like, it's flipping everything around, and it's handled really well how she makes the argument. And he is, I mean, I'm sure it was a more than this 10-minute phone call, but
yeah,
there, and then he and goes then a upstairs. 1 minute
conversation with Phil Knight.
And Phil Knight's like, fuck it. Yeah. Go ahead. But I'll say too, as a longtime Affleck apologist, that there are interesting connections with this film itself. He set up Equity with his key team. Mm-hmm. So his cinematographer, the editor, like how he treated the writer on this, they have back end in this film that they would not normally have at a film at this level.
Oh yeah,
this
is one of those movies where you can feel someone speaking through their film. Like, mm-hmm. like, you know, you can, like, this is essentially Ben Affleck being like, yeah, no, you know, this, like, I do care about, you know, everyone getting their fair share. I do care about, you know, labor rights. And truly, like I said, you know, Matt Damon's been on the up and up for me and, you know, really got pushed over by Josh's list. But, like, this film alone, I was like, this is the perfect film to watch going into these next couple of weeks in this negotiation. Absolutely. Where it's like, yeah, this is the worth. And it's so dynamic, and that's why I keep using the word self-aware, because even when in the end titles, when they're listing how much money people made, they're like, but Phil Knight also donated this much money. Like,
which I found that was a little bit of that kind of corporate.
Yeah, oh yeah. Where it's like, hey, we made a bunch of money, but we donated some of it. It was so funny.
You'll notice it says how much money Michael Jordan makes, and it says how much money Phil Knight donated.
Yeah.
It did not say how much money Phil Knight makes.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
another moment I thought, just to like circle back, I thought that whose performance we haven't checked yet is the one scene with Marlon Wayans.
I was just going to bring that up.
I thought he's so charming, and that I think is like if it wasn't a film intent on paying respect to like central figures and central Black figures to the story, I imagine that would be the first scene to go.
Yeah. 100%. When you brought that up, that's exactly what I was thinking.
Because beat, like the story beat of someone going like, you have to go through his family to get to go through the mother. That's who makes decisions. That's kind of already been said to him. And then he goes to talk with Jordan's former coach, who's his friend. And he kind of reiterates the same thing. But there's this kind of, they talk about him having been security for Martin Luther King. And like, so it really, I think it's really an intentional way to like root the story more firmly in Black history.
Yeah.
Well, it's also giving you, we've already seen Matt Damon, like as this talent scout, he's meeting young Black players at the very mm-hmm. beginning. And it's like, I'm here, I'm invested in your future. I see you and I see talent and potential. And then you find out that George Raveling, the Wyans character, was his best man at his wedding. Mm-hmm. And the connection of like, it's exactly what you were speaking about earlier, that fine line of how this is addressing white corporate America taking advantage of and working alongside, collaborating with Black talent. And so if you're centering Sonny Vaccaro in this, making it a broader thing that like, oh, actually, this is a man who's, it's not a new thing to him to be viewing mm-hmm. this. Yeah. I love that scene. It was also the scene when you said, Alonzo, that he was thinking of Sidney Lumet. That scene in the bar, I was like, oh, someone did a Soderbergh shoot. Like, just, it was the one thing, like, Matt Damon kept coming in and out of focus. It was all very handheld. I'm like, oh, what a fun tweak in this one scene.
I found especially the way it was directed, and this goes to the writing and performance as well, obviously, but like the first two-thirds, like up until Matt Damon gives that big speech in the conference room to sell Jordan on Nike, up until that point, it was like an incredibly breezy pacing. Like I was like, it almost felt like, I think The Social Network paces kind of a small story similarly, where you're like, how did they get so much like breezy plotting out of so little like action?
Yeah.
Well, for sure. It's time to vote. I did it before the Drea chant. Let's vote.
And the way we vote for things.
The way we vote for things on this show is screen it being the highest, stream it being the next level, skip it being self-explanatory. So who wants to kick it off?
You know, it's funny. Last week I said that that seeing Super Mario kicked me from stream it to screen it on air or on Dungeons and Dragons. And this week Seeing Tetris kicks me up from stream it to screen it, because that movie is does such a terrible job of telling a similar true story about how this thing came together through all these complications. And there's so much people running in and out of rooms, negotiating in an office, mm-hmm. and none of it is interesting. And it really made me appreciate all the things that this movie does, the hoops, if you will, that it jumps through to make this cinematically interesting, like you were saying, to tell, give you all this plot and all this information while so little is seemingly happening. So I think it's a very satisfying film. I have issues with certain choices. The amount of 1984 needle drops, including scores from 1984 movies, is insane. But nonetheless, I really enjoyed myself, and I was not inclined to care about any of this. So yeah, screen it.
I'm also a screen it. I very much enjoyed this. The music was nonstop, but I very much enjoyed it also. I didn't care. They also kept doing this thing where they were switching that a track would go from the score
to diegetic.
And I was like, ooh, yeah, that's
Matt Damon
fun.
Is not listening to Blister in the Sun in 1984.
Oh, absolutely not. When they start with him listening to Violent Femmes, I was like, nah.
It's right at the beginning.
Right at the top of the film, yeah.
He's just cruising along in his Buick to the Violent Femmes. Sure, why not? But yeah, this flew by. This felt like 15 minutes. It was super enjoyable. Like I said, I was still right in there, even though I did suspect how it was going to end. But, you know, I never knew what percentage of red was allowed in one of those shoes before. So, I mean, I walked away with new knowledge, but very, very enjoyable time. Screen it. Yeah.
I'll go. I'm going to vote a strong stream it. And maybe this is specifically from Massachusetts I am, but stream it with your dad over Thanksgiving. This is a perfect visit home streaming. It's 8:00. What the hell do you do at a parent's house at 8 p.m.? You can't go to bed. There's nowhere to go out. So you stream this movie. Nobody fucks weird. There's nothing that's going to make your parents be like, well, this changes our dynamic as adults. It is like an absolutely perfect stream it. Like, put it on. Like, there's a little cursing that there's, but it's like, there's nothing that's going to rock the boat too much. And it's 2 hours go by very quickly. Great performances. Everyone's mom will love Viola Davis. I think it's like yes, stream it as an adult with hanging out with adult family.
Ooh. Solid.
Yes. 2 hours, you don't have to speak to them.
Absolutely.
Good specificity.
Not.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm also a screen it. Yeah, that was a fun ride. It was funny seeing the Trivial Pursuit moment. But I will say the Born in the USA conversation with Jason Bateman was very hilarious and great. Look, Jay Bates out here doing great work. But with that, that's air. So we'll be right back after we hear from another show for Maximum Fun. So stay right there.
Since we reached our highest milestone during the Max Fun Drive, we are creating a Max Fun Foley library full of sound effects from your favorite hosts. The whole Max Fun community will be able to use it. So, what would you like it to feature? People high-fiving? Walking through mud? Chicken clucking? Jazz kazoo? Head to MaximumFun.org/Foley. That's MaximumFun.org/FOLEY and submit your ideas. We're excited to make this silly thing together and even more excited to see what you all create with it. And thank you again for a great Max Fun Drive.
Back to Maximum Film. I'm your host, Ivy Wadaway. In the studio with me are
Alonso Duraldi,
Josh Gondelman,
Drea Clark.
And today's movie looks back at the early days of Nike. It's focused on recognizable brand recalls, past films like The Social Network about Facebook, The Founder about McDonald's, or the new Tetris about Well, Tetris, and you know, you got a quick review from Alonzo. Whether it's an origin story or a tale of corporate self-destruction, the CEO pick has become the genre all on its own in the 21st century. So what company's story do you think would make a good movie, or at least funny to talk about and imagine?
Mm-hmm.
Does anyone have anyone? Because I got one. I'm ready. Oh,
you know that I do, and I'm going to say that me saying it on our show is me optioning this. That's got to count, right? Like in some sort of way?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So in 1956, a woman named Betty Nesmith Graham invented what became liquid paper. So she was she dropped out of high school young. She became a secretary and then an executive assistant secretary. And as a typist, so she was the one who invented like the paint that you would put on the paper and type it out. And then it was turned down by like whatever major company like she tried to sell it to. And then jokes on them, because then like four years later, she sold it to Gillette for $47 million. Wow. But many fun facts about this. Her single child, she had one kid, and the son that she had, whose friends helped her like package it up and sell it, and she was selling it all to the typists, was Michael Nesmith from The Monkees.
That's right.
Wow. Which I double enjoy. And so she named it Mistake Out, which was very funny to me. And then it became liquid paper. But I very much enjoy that. I would like to see something, a film about old Betty Nesmith Graham. And I'm sure there's all sorts of weird things there. And then also, in the 80s, there were problems and she had to reassess things because there were concerns over recreational sniffing. Mm. And if you don't think I won't enjoy doing the coda at the end with the phrase recreational sniffing, it's as if we've never met.
Yeah. Oh. And Andrea, relevant to your interest, Michael Nesmith was a pioneer in the world of music video.
It's true. It's true.
He won the first Grammy, I want to say, for a music video for his Elephant Parts compilation.
And was acquitted, but he was the one that killed the radio star.
It's true.
He was found civilly liable, but was acquitted in the criminal trial.
But he had a really good lawyer, so.
Yeah, he's technically responsible for the wrongful death of the radio star.
Yeah, yeah.
They knocked it down to manslaughter.
Murder remains unsolved.
Mine has to be, for me, in much in the same vein. So there used to be a system called Sega Dreamcast that rocked all of our worlds because it had Sonic Adventure, which was like an action adventure version of Sonic. It like, you know, carried a lot of popular games to the forefront, but its big competition was the Sony PlayStation 2. And what has been attributed to the Dreamcast, Sega Dreamcast's failure is that Sega was announced it and announced the release date, and Sony then released the release date of the PlayStation 2 after the Dreamcast, and since it was like just a little bit more expensive, a lot of people were able to take their reservation, their pre-orders for the Dreamcast and put it towards the PlayStation 2, and then they beat it out. And I still think of that as the biggest dick move in the history. It was some kind of TV documentary where it was revealed that Sony knew and they were waiting for Sega to announce their release date so that they can do it after and do that play.
I love that story, and I also love that you just said the phrases beat it out and biggest dick mood within, like, seconds of each other.
You know, sometimes it's just a passive horniness. You know, I don't even...
It's
just right there. It's always just under the surface. Yeah.
Andrea, it was the Sega Dreamcast, which we were all into.
Yeah, yeah.
Edge of my seat.
Every single one of us.
Yeah, yeah.
I love
Everyone
it.
Everyone in here wanted a Sega Dreamcast.
That's how I learned how to cast my dreams.
And the horny version, obviously, the Sega Wet Dreamcast.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, I think a Lonzo friendly horny biopic would be the HD DVD versus Blu-ray wars. that was won out by porno.
This is true. Yeah, you know, well, I think much like the VHS beta wars, which were like, you know, Sony was going to be proprietary about a beta, but anybody could make VHS. And so guess what won? Mine was, I was first I thought, well, you know, the new Coke. That's like one of the great fiascos of my life. But I thought, too obvious. And then I remembered that there's another debacle of the Coca-Cola company that I'm more interested in. They test marketed a product in the 90s called OK Cola. And the cola itself is whatever. But the whole marketing thing behind it was that it was they were going to get Generation X. And they were going to get Generation X by doing a very sort of laid back, like cynical, you know, it's an ad campaign and we're giving you an ad campaign. Buy our soda, I guess. They bought previously existing Dan Clowes artwork and used it on the cans.
Wow.
What? And it flopped. And there's a whole history of like terrible Gen X advertising, from the legendary It's Like Punk But a Car to the Mr. Delicious character for the Midwest fast food chain Rax, R-A-X, which Google it and go down that rabbit hole. But I think an OK Cola movie animated by Dan Clowes would be awesome.
Huge.
Yeah.
Would watch. I want you to know that the exact commercials I'm picturing for that are those interstitials in Reality Bites when the like MTV company takes over her documentary.
That was what my people, they thought we were going to be, you know.
You know who's going to love an apathetic soda? Yeah. Exactly.
This is the soda for Janine Garofalo. Specifically.
Melrose Place was a really great show. Yeah.
The woman who told us that Evian is naive spelled backwards.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
Josh, what about you?
Okay, we talked about Air tonight. We're sticking close to this theme. This is a story about a man with a big dream that inside a shiny head. A man named Cy Sperling, who is not only the president of his company, but also a client. This is the Hair Club for Men story, or as we're going to call it, Hair. And, and I know there's already a thing called that, but we're going to do it anyway. Hey, because I think how fascinating that there were so many hair replacement products that were just out in the world before they worked at all. Like, there were dudes, like, famous actors going on TV being like, did half your head get caught in a weed whacker? What's going on here? And I just think that era of like male vanity, like the soothing of male vanity without any actual, it's like the emperor has some clothes. It's like, is the emperor wearing
a tube
top?
Tell their clothes.
Yeah. So it's, that's what I want to see. I want to see the rise and fall of the Hair Club for Men.
I'd watch that. Oh, you also said his name and I was like, I know who that is. Why do I? And that's exactly the level of familiarity you want for this.
Not only the president, also a client.
Yep.
And as a bald, you hate to see it. You hate to lose a good man. I rewatched all of Seinfeld recently, like early pandemic 2020, and there's a season like where the season premiere and Jason Alexander just has hair and you're like, you were a beloved bald. You did it. You don't need hair. We all loved you bald.
I do remember when he did that though.
And now he's back to bald.
Yeah. As he should be.
Nature has been restored.
Right. Nature abhors a Flobee, as they say.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Yeah. So to all the agents and stuff listening, you know, executives and such, go ahead and hit our email. You know, that's maximumfilm@maximumfun.org. And let us know if you want to purchase any of those, and we'll connect you with the right person.
I just got a text. My agent just dropped me, actually.
Oh.
The Writers Guild just said, you don't get to strike.
Yeah, you're actually, it's not a strike. You just don't stop writing.
Well, my favorite part about that is Josh actually pulled out his phone to do that bit. And so that was for us.
I just wanted you to buy into what my object work.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not a good improviser. I have to have the phone, literally.
It's a prop comic.
Because otherwise I do it like this. I do the bad improv phone. Yeah. Pinky the thumb.
Oh. All right, well, Let's roll right into staff picks. It could be any movie at all. Who has any picks?
I've got one. This might have been recommended on the show already because it's not a new movie, but I finally, for the first time, speaking of Steven Soderbergh, as we were earlier, saw Out of Sight with George Clooney and Ms. Ben Affleck, Jennifer Lopez. And it's so fun. Incredible cast. We got Ving Rhames. We got Don Cheadle. It's so Steve Zahn. It's great. It's like a little bit sexy, a little bit heisty. It's, yeah, it's a good time. I think it's heisty, it's sexy. It's like a caper with, Catherine Keener's in it. I don't know. It's just a lot of fun. There's like a long scene at the beginning where they're just like in the, George Clooney and Jennifer Lopez are just in the trunk of a car together. And
so
it
hot.
Rules. It's so hot.
It's stupid
One
hot.
Of the sexiest
it's
scenes
so
ever.
So sexy. And then the movie just like pulls away. Like there's like other times like where there's flirtation, but the movie just comes on so horny. And then there's like, okay, here's like another half hour cold water because we can't keep escalating from here. People in the seats will be too horned up.
I do want to say Out of Sight really set me up for disappointment for the first time. I got stuck in a trunk with a man and I was like, this is not what I thought
Always
it would be
better
like.
In the movies.
It got a little better the times after that, but still not great. Still not great.
Well, you know what, Josh, you've inspired me to totally throw my earlier ideas out of the window because I was torn between do I take the high road and recommend Hoop Dreams? Mm. Do I go ultra gay and talk about the documentaries about Salvatore Ferragamo and Manolo Blahnik and talk about shoes? But no, I'm going to do a really good basketball movie that's also about labor and that's directed by Steven Soderbergh, and that would be High Flying
Hell
Bird.
Yeah.
Where Andre Holland plays a sports agent and there's a lockout going on. The NBA players are on strike and he's trying to get a rookie involved and has to deal with various factors, including the rookie sort of coach and mentor who is, you know, constantly high-minded and trying to make these guys be better and do better. And the film really takes a bold stance about treating NBA players as people who are, you know, in a labor union essentially, and making sure they get fair treatment from the bosses. All of this wrapped up in a really compelling drama that was apparently shot on a cell phone. So, High Flying Bird.
That movie, again, in terms of messing with my expectations, the agents I have to deal with as a producer are never the Andre Holland. They're always the Chris Messina. Mm-hmm. It's a whole different, yeah.
Oh, and it's on Netflix.
Oh, nice. Okay, well, mine is a new film, and it doesn't have anything to do with basketball, but it does sort of have to do with heists.
Okay.
It is called Polite Society. It is one of my favorites out of this year, Sundance. Nita Manzura directed it. She has an amazing show that not enough people watch, so please go watch We Are Lady Parts. Highly recommend it.
I love it.
And... Polite Society is about two sisters. The younger one is practicing and learning martial arts because she wants to become a stunt woman. And then her older sister is in art school and all this. And then she meets this guy, gets engaged, and all of the younger sisters' like red flags go off. And she decides that she and her friends are going to do a wedding heist. So there's a lot of martial arts. It's sort of martial arts meets Bollywood meets kind of modern day Austin culture and class stuff, sister stuff. It's fast and gorgeous. It has sort of
Austin the author, not Austin the
Steve. Austin the author,
oh, okay.
Thank you. Yeah,
well, no, and also
that's
not
a good
the
point.
Stone Cold Steve.
Yes, that's fair.
No.
But it's great. It's very good fun. And it has that sort of Scott Pilgrim, like, oh, there's a lot of things going on in this movie. And I love seeing that from... a female artist who I think is doing the interesting work that Nita Manzor is doing. So go see that. It comes out April 28th, I think, is the wide release. And this is the kind of film that, you know, box office dollars are how you support movie making. So there you go.
Yeah. And speaking of supporting cinema, let's talk about supporting the Damon. If you're demanding Damon after this film, if you want some more Matt Damon, I went to look through the annals of his cinematic history to go ahead and pitch this one, which I'm sure will get a Criterion release any day now, and it is none other than Mystic Pizza. Go ahead and watch Mystic Pizza. See your boy Matt Damon, early Matt Damon, in that 4 years after this movie takes place, if you want to track it.
He has a little less screen time in that one.
A little, just a,
just a little less.
A smidgen. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I remember interviewing him at a round table for the movie School Ties, and nobody knew who he was, and we all just sort of looked at him.
Aww.
Yeah, I know. Look at him now.
And now he's turned into, he is ascending into the title of America's dad that Tom Hanks has been living in for so long.
Oh, definitely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, look, thanks to the great Josh Gondelman, what do you want people to know about? What are you working on?
Oh, my goodness. I have a newsletter that I write every Monday. It's full of pep talks, and that's most of it. And I'm about to go on a probably 20-plus city stand-up tour. JoshGondelman.com is where you find that. And new dates are always announced in the newsletter. It's now that social media, especially Twitter, is crumbling to dust. Subscribe to the newsletter, read that. Tour dates. I have a stand-up special called People Pleaser in the United States. You can watch it for free on YouTube. And I did a little writing for the currently airing final season of The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel.
Nice.
Ooh, thank you.
Josh is hands down, other than of course Iffy and Alonso, my favorite part of Twitter.
Oh,
and
thank
regularly
you.
Like the funniest thing that I read, but also very positive, but in a very funny way. And then like even just Iffy's referenced it a few times. You did this recent article about like the most Boston people ever, and you had me because one of them was not House of Pain.
Not House of
and
Pain.
I was like, I love this guy.
Ify, you said, what should people know? And I took it as, what should I plug? But I do think people should know House of Pain isn't from Boston. That's really important to me that people remember that. It's unfair.
Yeah.
Die on that hill.
Yeah. No, it was a great list. Beacon Hill. Just every step of the way. Dre and Alonzo, thank you for another wonderful show. Always good. And you, the listener, guess what? Next week we're watching Little Richard, I Am Everything. So go ahead and watch that if you want to be up on the moves by the time that we drop the pod. If you have a comment or suggestion about this week's show, tweet at us at Maximal_film. Our Facebook group can be found at www.facebook.com/groups/maximumfilm, or send us an email at maximumfilm@maximumfun.org. Our producer is the wonderful Marissa Flaxbart. Our senior producer is also wonderful, and her name is Laura Swisher. And this is a production of Maximum Fun. Bye-bye.
Yay!
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.